Jacob exercised by chastisement there in Hebrews 12, it tells us that if we are truly a child of God, then God will chastise us. He teaches us by that spanking, by that chastisement. Chastisement is not penalty, it is not punishment. Punishment is just its own purpose, but chastisement is for the purpose of teaching, of correcting. God, in love, chastises those that he calls his own. This morning, we saw Jacob, as we were mentioning, he's, by our terms, an elderly man, but he, in his terms and his lifespan, he was a young man. He was just leaving home, hadn't been married yet, going and hadn't experienced any children and family and the joys of in-laws. And so he was just beginning. And there, as he was ready to leave the promised land up into Syria, God met him in a vision, a dream, showed him this, and my imagination, a grand staircase, gilt edges, and red and gold on the steps, and at the very top, God himself standing or sitting on an exalted throne, turns and looks at him. I always remember a time, just me, but we were traveling back when I had gone out on what we called extension, which means extending your outreach. We went to some city, probably up in northern South Carolina, to pass out tracts and witness to people on the street. On the way back, I was relegated to the very back end of a station wagon, which in those days it didn't matter too much. I could get in and out all right. And we were going through the countryside where the stars were allowed to shine just brilliantly. And I remember kind of leaning back and looking out there and seeing this, what, I don't know, millions of stars twinkling down upon us, and seeing this as the place of God. And I had this thing in my imagination as though the stars were actually points of light on something that turns out to be a face as it turned and looked at me in the car as we were traveling on the road. And this was God. Just my imagination, you understand. He didn't tell me to kill the drivers or anything. Just my imagination. But this was the grand sky, which was the face of God. And there was that fear that Jacob talked about, we were saying this morning, this sense that this is so much bigger than me. It was a remarkable, remarkable feeling. And I kind of treasure it because I know it wasn't a real vision. It was just that sense that God was greater than the universe. And that when we were praying, which is what we were doing, taking turns, and I was looking up at the sky as I was listening to the men pray, he actually pays attention. He actually listens. He's hearing what we're saying. And it was almost upsetting your stomach. It's just so vivid, so strange. He saw the vision of God, and he said, if you are what you claim you are, if you do what you claim you will do, then I will make you my personal God. You will be my God. And so with the angels ascending and descending on this grand staircase, he left in the morning and continued his journey. Now, I've skipped over the whole 20 years that he was gone. Let's just say that he met the girl of his dreams and asked if he could marry her. And the guy said, well, sure, we're glad to have family from down south come up and marry our daughter. And now, you know, here we bundle up the girl really well before when we get her married. And so he didn't think anything about it till he got in the tent and unwrapped his present, and it was the other sister. He went, what? Wait a minute. How could he have got this wrong? Well, he says, oh, no, I thought you understood. We always marry off the older first. And can you imagine that? Somebody actually deceived Jacob, pretended to be somebody else. Uh-huh. God has that, dare I say, wicked sense of humor. You know, he will bring these things back to you. Well, he had arrived a fairly poor man. He didn't have, a flock of sheep. He didn't have a herd of camels, to offer as his dowry to the father. So he said, I will work for you for 7 years. And so they agreed. Well, it was the other wife. And so he said, well, I think you're a good guy, and you give her this, your new wife, your unexpected wife, you give her due diligence, and I'll let you marry the other one too. Of course, you'll owe me another 7 years. So 14 years he spends. Now, you should understand that he doesn't grieve about this. In fact, he loves his beloved, his soulmate, so much that it says that the days just flew by. His love of her was so great. So he was okay with all of this. But he was a Hebrew. He was of Abraham and Isaac. And one of the things that really bothered him was that his father-in-law, who was his employer, over the period of time he was there, changed his wages 10 times. It ends up that he'd say, you can have this much of the flock as it increases. Well, the flock increased so much that he didn't want to give him that much. And he says, well, then you will take a lesser amount, you know. And so finally he set up the idea that if I'll just take all the ones that where the wool is strange, where it's spotted or striped and so on. And then he set up a way of kind of doing it on his own that doesn't make any sense at all. But he had striped poles that he put out there. And the goats, of course, and the sheep, looking at those, would bear striped children. Aren't you glad that's not true? I mean, you ladies who bore children in houses with strange wallpaper, why do your children have roses on their sides of their faces? Just what we were looking at. Well, anyway, that doesn't make any sense. I don't think genetically that makes any sense at all. But he was convinced that was what was happening. What really was happening is God said, I am invested in blessing you greatly. Then the time came when he was actually had accumulated in flocks and helpers. He had accumulated enough that his father-in-law didn't have as much or was nearly about the same. And he was noticing that the sons of Laban started talking. You know, I don't know what it was exactly, but they were upset with him. We're going to have to do something to get this back for our father. He's stealing from our father somehow. We can't prove it, but we don't know how he's doing it. And so he talks to his wives, and he says, we need to leave. And they said, let's go. Now, the whole family unit was a little diseased in spiritually because the his soulmate steals the household idols. These are the people supposed to be from, you know, from the Hebrew line, and they're supposed to know the true and living God, and they did by mouth, but they had these household idols. And I don't know, somebody has said, well, you get to if you own the household idols, then on the death of the father, you inherit things. This was the mark of that. And I don't know. I don't think that the society heritage of that place was so well known that that can be said. I think it's just people guessing why. At any rate, what we do see is that they had a really low view of separation. And this is what he was becoming a man, a family man, in the midst of all of this. And I think that this was the time when he determined to leave, and God was moving to get his children out from underneath that influence. And so the 11th of his children were born. Joseph was born. Benjamin was ready to come. Or is that the 12th and the 13th was coming? Anyway, I forget how that works. With Levi, I think it was the 13th coming. Benjamin hadn't been born yet. But evidently was they were ready for however many children. Well, Jacob decides to leave. And because he doesn't trust what he's been hearing from Laban's sons, he decides to go quietly. Now, if you own all of this stuff, leaving quietly, I mean, no race car engines or anything like this, but they were separated from Laban's people and flock. So they just packed up and they made sure that nobody went back in to do this or that and so on, and they just left. Well, Laban then wasn't too long when he found out about this. And so thundering off in the distance comes a group of people chasing down Jacob and the family. And it's Laban, and Jacob's a little nervous. Two reasons to be nervous, though he didn't know one, and that was that his wife Rachel had actually stolen the household idols. So anyway, Laban gets there and he says, why are you sneaking off in the middle of the night? He says, well, I thought maybe you'd decide to keep my wives, your daughters, and I just didn't think I could trust you, frankly. And he said, well, it really makes me upset. And he says, but something happened last night. The true God appeared to me and said, don't speak evil or good to him. Promise him nothing. Don't speak any evil to him, or I'll get you. And Laban said, yeah, I don't want to mess with him. So he says, I would be upset if God hadn't told me this, so I'm just saying to you, why did you steal my household idols? And Jacob is basically saying, what would I want with that? You're afraid because the true God spoke to you. He didn't know. So Rachel has her own little deception. It ends up that camel saddles are oddly made so that they fit on humps and things. And they make them like boxes that can be opened and things can be stored in it. It's the camel's trunk, like we have car trunks. And and then when you took them off the camel, you could put them in the tent and you'd have a chair. So that worked like that. Well, she put the household idols in the saddle and sat on it. And when her father came in, because Jacob in his naivete said, well, we didn't steal anything. If you find any of your things, that you can take that person's life. Well, he never would have said that if he'd known it was Rachel. when Rachel's father comes in, she says, "Oh, I'm sorry, it's really my time of the month. I can't stand to honor you, but I'm going to stay seated here." And he says, "Hey, yeah, don't worry about that." But he looks all around. Well, then it's Jacob's time to be upset. So now Jacob becomes angry and he says, "You come chasing me down like I'm a thief in the night, and look what you've done." And this is where he tells him. He says, "You changed my wages 10 times during the 20 years that I've served you." And because he had asked to leave right after Joseph was born, and he said, "Well, stay around." So he had another 6 years, a total of 20 years. And so they make a pact with each other, a non-aggression pact, that they'll do each other no harm, and they leave. Well, Laban is behind him, and he crosses over into the promised land, and this is where we find verses 1 and 2. We find God's heavenly reminder. Verses 1 and 2, "Jacob went on his way," and notice how casually this is mentioned, "and the angels of God met him." This is just a regular word, met him, like, "Oh, hi, there's Jacob again," you know, and just walking up there. "And when Jacob saw them, he said, 'This is God's host.'" A host is an army, is an encampment. "And he called the name of the place Mahanaim." The King James margin tells us that means two hosts, two camps. So Jacob left Laban and his threats. He pursued his journey home. "Went" is in the perfect tense. He had completed leaving. You see that sense of it. He kind of dusted his hands off with Laban and the family. And leaving Syria, he comes now into Canaan. And here, the angels of God met him. "Met" is in the imperfect tense, kind of indicating that there was a continual process. It's like we go back to that ladder and they were ascending. That was the first word. They were ascending. So they were walking around the earth doing something and walking to the ladder to get back up to God. And here he meets them as they're going through. So when he perceived them, he met them when he saw them. This is the word, general word, it means to see, as if in the, when you say, oh, I see, I understand. It's that word. It can be used about perception. So when he perceived them, he recognized that they were gathered together as an encampment. This is like the army gathers together in an encampment. And so he calls them a host. And, you know, when in the Bible do you ever find somebody meeting an angel and the angel doesn't say, "Fear not," or that it says that they were sore afraid, you know? Catherine loves to play the xylophone when sitting in church. So. But he's not afraid. He knows these guys. He's met them before, you see. And so he is not afraid. We read nothing of that, but rather encouraged. And he says, "Well, look at that. I have a host. God has blessed me with a host. I have, you know, animals beyond a number, really, and this huge family, 11, 12 sons, as well as whatever daughters." And he found it as an encouragement, God's heavenly host joining his earthly host. And he seems to see it as a safeguard. He reminds himself of the words of God who said, "I will be with you and keep you safe until I bring you back." The angels surely reminded him of the dream that he had when he was leaving Canaan. God had promised not to leave him, and now he sees supernatural evidence that this is true. God has shown himself not only by the great blessing of building up his wealth in that time, but of protection. So the angelic host was an encouragement, since he now didn't have to worry about Laban, but he was going to have to meet Esau. So he turns his attention to this, encouraged, I think, by the fact that the angels are there. God is showing that he's ready to help. We find Jacob's hope and fear. Hope, fear. Look at verses 3 through 8. Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother. Messenger is the same word for angel here. The angels remind me, I need to send messengers. So he sent him to Esau, his brother, unto the land of Seir, the country or the field of Edom. Now, last we heard, Esau was living in Beersheba with the family. In these 20 years, he's gone away, and Jacob knew this. So he commanded them, the messengers, saying, "Thus shall ye speak." He's giving them precise words unto my lord Esau, my master Esau. "Thy servant Jacob saith thus." So you see how he's couching. He's not saying, "Hey, I'm pretty powerful now, you better watch out, you better leave me alone." None of that. He's saying, you're the boss, and I'm your servant. He says, "I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen and asses, flocks, men servants, women servants, and I have sent to tell my lord," not to brag about it, but to tell my lord, "that I may find grace in thy sight." So he tells him about God's blessing. And the messengers returned to Jacob, I don't know how much later, a couple of days maybe, and saying, "We came to thy brother Esau, but he's not in Edom anymore." This is why we're back so soon. "We came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him." Oh, great. Not only did Jacob know where Esau was supposed to be, Esau was keeping tabs on this as well. "Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people that was with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two bands, and said, 'If Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape.'" He has no illusion that with his prowess as a hunter, cunning hunter, with his power with 400 men, and maybe he had heard the point of having this standing army, as it were, is because he was showing his dominance. Esau was showing his dominance in Edom. He was conquering them and taking over. This was going to be his land. In fact, Edom is named for him. So he says, if he comes and attacks, he's going to smite badly, but we're going to divide his focus and divide it up. So I'm guessing that Laban, being a businessman and all this, he was maintained connections with Canaan. Jacob had learned through this that Esau had left Beersheba and was establishing his dominance in Edom. Perhaps he had heard reports of vicious attacks and conquering of others and things like this. He sent quickly moving messengers, moving far faster than his huge group, with carefully worded message, "Thou shalt speak unto my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob saith thus." He seems to communicate by telling him what he has, that he needed nothing from Esau. "I'm coming back home, but I don't need anything from you." And he would not try to take anything. "I have sufficient." He had plenty. He defines the purpose of the message is that I might find grace in thy sight. And grace refers to favor, often translated favor. I hope you'll be happy with me. I don't need anything from you. I'm not trying to take anything from you. No one-upsmanship on this thing. I'm just back. God is blessed. And I hope I'm okay with you. You're okay with me. When the messengers returned, they gave the surprising and fearful news. Esau was not resting in Edom, but on the march to meet Jacob. And oh, by the way, He has an army of 400 men with him. And Jacob felt both fear, that's the internal thing, and distress. This is that discomfort. This is the word comes from the essence of being pressed in, compressed. So he begins plans to minimize damage if his brother would attack. So, you know what you and I would do? We find that such a thing is imminent and we have no missiles to fire, no, we have no power to withstand this. We go to God in prayer. So we see, thirdly, Jacob's prayer. Look at verses 9 to 12. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord Jehovah, which saith to me, I remember your words very clearly, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. Now, you could almost imagine with those words, he's going to start making some sort of a deal bargain with God, saying, now look, you got to keep your word here and this type of thing. But notice, he just humbly bows. He says, I am not worthy of the least. And actually, he says, I am less than all of the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. You have given me truth and blessing, and of all those things, I'm the least part of it. I'm not worthy of anything. He basically is saying, I'm not here to demand anything from you, God. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan. He says, I was so rich I had a stick in my hand when I left, and now I'm become two bands. He separated them out. Huge flocks and keepers and family. So now with that he asks the great request, deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him. And here's the real fear, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children, with the mother upon the children, you see. For thou saidst, and here is God's promise that doesn't allow for all of his family to die. Thou saidst, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for the multitude. So he's saying, I'm going to trust your word, and I need delivered. My family needs delivered here. So he turned to God. He addresses him in the covenant relationship with his family. He recalls his words when he left the country, return unto the country, to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. The prayer does not demand anything from God, but humbly pleads for deliverance from danger. And he recounts God's blessing to him and accounts himself unworthy of them all. He is reminding himself of the man that he was when he came. When you and I come face to face with the consequences of our actions, no matter how justified those actions were at the time, in our thinking, there are consequences for these things. And when we face them, we are humbled. We say things like, I should have known. I should have paid attention to what God told me, what my parents told me. I should have. So we're humbled. We realize that much of life is out of our control. Jacob is, you know, sort of on top of the world. He's got everything he wanted. He's a powerful person himself. And now a brother with an army can come and wipe it out. He's not controlling his life. We turn to God, who is always in control. And Jacob requests safety for his wives and children based on God's promise, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea. Well, we find this prayer done, and he seems to be satisfied that he said everything that he needs to say. We find the next point is that Jacob's reconciliation. He's not one of those who would then pray and then just go about his business, you know. He thinks, if God is going to bless me, then I ought to be doing something for him to bless. I ought to be doing my part to show my repentance, to show my desire for reconciliation with my brother, to show how sorry I am for treating him as I did with that deception, and to show him that after all of this, I love him. And so we find his plan of reconciliation, 13 to 23. And he lodged there that same night, and took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau his brother. Here's what he decided to give: 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, enough to maintain the 200. 200 ewes and 20 rams. This is, you know, a gift that keeps on giving. 30 milk camels with their colts. The colts are left unnumbered here, but these are camels that are giving suck to their colts. 40 kine cattle and 10 bulls. 20 she asses and 10 foals, the baby donkeys. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and said unto his servants, pass over before me, and put a space betwixt drove and drove. I want you to come stage by stage to my brother Esau. Now he says, and he commanded the foremost, the very first one, saying, when Esau my brother meeteth thee, and ask thee, saying, whose art thou? Because obviously he would be a servant. And whither goest thou? And whose are these before thee? What's going on with this group of animals? Then thou shalt say, they be thy servant Jacob's. It is a present sent unto my lord Esau. And behold, also he is behind us. And so commanded he the second and the third and all that followed the drove, saying, on this manner shall ye speak unto Esau when ye shall find him. I find that to be a pretty interesting concept. And say ye, moreover, behold, my servant Jacob is behind us. Each time he's looking then for the next approach, and that's going to be Jacob. But instead, it's another gift. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goeth before me. And afterward I will see his face. Peradventure, he will accept of me. He will accept my face. So went the present over before him, and himself lodged that night in the company. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons, there's the number, and passed over the ford Jabbok. And he took them and sent them, caused them to pass over the brook, and sent over what he had. So having divided them up, he sends them in two companies to move on ahead. The wives and children moving no faster than the flocks. A pretty good idea here. Once he turned things over to God, I'm impressed that he didn't hesitate to do the best he could. You know, do the best you can, but leave the rest to God. He left the rest to God first, and then he did the best he could. He decided to control his meeting with Esau with gifts representing his respect and his love. So he pulled from his flocks more than 550 animals. That's a lot, isn't it? And he ordered them in several ranks. Each drove of animals was spaced so that Esau would receive them one at a time. Each drove would announce itself as a gift to Esau from Jacob, who was coming behind, and he had enough animals to make, and he doesn't say how many, but he could have 10 droves of over 50 animals apiece. So if you saw a whole herd of 50 nice animals coming, you say, well, that is a pretty nice gift. And then the next one. And then the next one. I mean, imagine that 10 times. Is there any end to what he's doing here? The repetition would be impressive in itself. It would emphasize the enormity of the gift and therefore the respect and love that he was offering. Last of all, he gathered his family and sent them before him. He stayed at the brook Jabbok for the night. And that brings us to God dealing with him in chastisement on a very personal level. And again, as we saw this morning, God dealt with him personally, and he said, "Then you will be my God." Now we find God dealing with him personally. Let's read verses 24 to 32. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day, the ascending of the morning. It was a wrestling match. This is just left completely unexplained. What in the world is going on? And when he saw that he, this is the wrestler, prevailed not against him, against Jacob, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. When my right knee went out of joint, I had to stop wrestling because I couldn't move it back and forth or it popped back out of joint. It was very, very painful. He kept on wrestling. And he said to Jacob, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." And he said, "I will not let thee go except thou bless me." This means that through the night and this wrestling match, he knew who he was wrestling. And he said unto him, "What is thy name?" He said, "Jacob." Were you just wrestling a random person here? "It's me, Jacob." And he said, "The name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel." And the King James tells us it means a prince of God. "For as a prince thou hast power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." And Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me, I pray thee, thy name." And he said, "Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?" Do you really need to know? And he, God, blessed him, Jacob, there. He gave in to his request. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, that is, the face of God. "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." And as he passed over, Penuel the sun rose upon him, and he halted, he limped upon his thigh. Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh, unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. So they passed this tradition on. Why aren't we eating this one? Well, this just reminds us of what happened with Jacob. Wrestled, I found, was interesting. It's a passive verb indicating that Jacob was being wrestled. You see, this was God doing it to Jacob. Jacob didn't pick a fight here. People have imagined that this was him determining to wrestle with God until he got blessed. He was being wrestled, you see. His opponent is first called a man, but of course that's how Jacob would have perceived him. Can you imagine what he must have thought when, as he's laying down again, perhaps remembering that dream that he had so long ago, 20 years before, and all of a sudden he's in a wrestling match with no referee in the night. And, did Esau send an elite wrestler assassin? What's going on here? But God took up the struggle against Jacob. This is God fighting him and wearing him down. But Jacob just keeps on going. The night is passing. The sun is beginning to rise. And it dawns on Jacob, the big problem I have is not really with Esau. the problem I have is with God. I have not obeyed God. I have done that which was not according to His way. God's way is a way of love. You know, if you go back to that day with the mother saying we should have a deception here, and he had just decided to do things in the most loving way, loving his father, loving his brother. It would have been some sort of a discussion saying, do you really want to do this when God has made it so clear what his plan was? Who knows what would have happened, but he would have been guiltless. As the night proceeded, Jacob became aware, and we don't know exactly how that happened, that his opponent was more than a man. And so Jacob, while wrestling, desires a blessing from him. He has always been looking for the blessing, hasn't he? God asks his name, not that he didn't know, but to bring a focus on the change in Jacob. Jacob himself is changing, and God changes his name to Israel. Israel is a word made of two parts. The first part meaning power or prince. Actually, it sounds very much like Sarah when he changed Sarai's name to Sarah. It was this princess or person of power. But the first part is power or prince, and the second is God. So God explained, for as a prince hast thou power with God, with Elohim, the El part of Israel, and with men, and has prevailed. You have wrestled, as it were, with God and man, and have prevailed. We hear something of God's approval in this, even if he was not approving of how it was done. I mentioned this morning that I was surprised to recognize God. Christ had commented on the vision of the angels ascending and descending. But we have here another help in the book of Hosea. Hosea gives us an exposition on this name change. Now, he's arguing that God has trouble with Judah. But notice chapter 12, verses 3 and 4. He took his brother by the heel in the womb. He was the heel grabber. That's what Jacob was, you see. And by his strength he had power, and you see this word again, the Hebrew here, King James says, was a prince or behaved himself princely with God. So he grabbed his brother by the heel, and by his strength he had power with God. He was a prince with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. That sounds to me like that part where the whole hip joint went out of joint, and he kept on going, weeping and wailing, made supplication unto him. And he found him in Bethel. This could be that same place where he had seen the vision. And there he spake with us. Hosea calls the opponent the angel. Jacob recognized him as God. This was the angel of Jehovah, Jesus Christ, before he was born in Bethlehem. Jacob asked his name, but God asked him why he asked. Jacob already knew. So God blessed Jacob even as he touched his hip and dislocated the joint. When the Apostle Paul asked for his thorn in the flesh to be removed, God said, no, I've given it to you for a purpose, that you won't become absurdly proud by all the connection that you have with me. I need you to be a humble man speaking to men of God, and the power that you have, I want it to be in the words you say and not in you. So I need you damaged a bit. I've seen paintings that were beautifully done, but enhanced by kind of a scarred wood frame. It set the whole mood for what the painting was about. We find this is what's going on with Jacob. He touched the hip and dislocated the joint. Kylan Dalich explains it this way. Jacob overcame God, not with the power of the flesh, however, as though he would have a chance of overpowering God, with which he had hitherto wrestled for God against man. He had used his fleshliness to wrestle for the blessing with Esau and so on. God convinced him of that by touching his hip. You're not going to win by fleshly power here, young man. So that it was put out of joint. But how did he win? But by the power of faith and prayer, reaching by firm hold of God even to the point of being blessed, by which he proved himself to be a true wrestler of God. To wrestle with God and win? You say, what do I have to be, Superman? You have to be super submissive. You have to be a believer. You have to have faith. Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, that is the face of God, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. I take from this the lesson of God's chastisement, that God brings your wrong actions before you, even though he has forgiven you, even though perhaps you have asked for forgiveness. I've mentioned before, but one time a youth pastor asked me, and I don't know what was going on in his life, but he said, once we've asked God for forgiveness of sin, it's taken care of, right? We're not going to have that brought up again at the last judgment or something, are we? I said, well, you misunderstand what that's all about. The judgment seat is about how you ran the whole race. I said, if you were running the hurdle race, and you slammed into every hurdle and fell on your face and got cinders in your knees and ran over to the coach and said, I'm so sorry. And then you ran on and hit the next one. Oh, I'm so sorry. He says, you could end up going through the entire race fully forgiven, but really doing a horrible job in the race. Everybody else was jumping over it. So you're last one there. At the judgment seat, the question is, how well did you run? How well did you accomplish what God has set you to do? Well, I just kept running into my hurdles. But I asked for forgiveness. Yeah, but you certainly weren't effective, you see. You needed to learn from this, to be exercised by your chastisement, and jump a little higher. Accomplish what God has set for you to do. Jacob had been able to do his will and then run away to avoid the consequences. He can't do that now. During his time with Laban, God showed him the pain of deception and disrespect by switching wives on him. Now, God settles with him and he must limp forever after. He could run from Esau, but he couldn't run from God. Neither can we. God prepared Jacob to face life in complete dependence on God. As God sees him as the real start of this nation that he would call by his name, the nation of Jacob, the nation of Israel, he says, you need to get something down straight. That is, you can't do your will and just ask for forgiveness. You have to do it my way. You have to lead your family in my way. You have to keep them away from those idols, those household idols, and have them learn it my way. Or there are going to be consequences. And I'll bring the consequences to you. He tells us this each and every day. He says, you can't sin and get away with it. The very thing that we do, the sin, He has warned us against it because it's bad for us. And while we may be forgiven, those consequences still happen. We've got to learn to be exercised by the chastisement and stop doing the wrong thing. Do the right thing. Find the strength to overcome the weakness and do it right. Let's pray. Father, you have shown us in the life of Jacob that blessed as he was with the hundreds and hundreds of animals that made a wealthy man in that day, in that age, you have shown us that it took this, that true wrestling with thee, of recognizing that his problem in all of these things was with you, not just with man. The problems that this caused with men was a side issue. But sin is against you and you alone. I ask, Father, that you might impress upon us that you are there to help. You are there to instruct. But we can't just run our own way, because there are consequences that we will face if we do. With heads bowed, eyes closed. Perhaps you'd say, Pastor, I think I've allowed a little bit of Jacob to get into me and think that I can pull a fast one and most people won't know, or most people can't do anything about it. But I'm reminded tonight that God can, and God knows, and God will not be happy. And so one day, perhaps when I least expect it, I'm going to have to wrestle with God. And even though I might be blessed at the end, there'll be a crippling, there'll be a pain, there'll be something taken from me because there are consequences to sin. Therefore, I ask God now to teach me the lesson of wrestling, that is, to hold on for God's blessing and to desire it most of all in our life, not to try to justify doing it my way, but learning how to do it His way. If that's your prayer, would you lift your hands and say, pray for me. I need to do it God's way, and I need to fear the consequences that will come when I do my secret sins, when I go my own way, when I become my own boss. Pray for me. Our Father, then we do bow before you and pray, even as as Jacob did, that we're not worthy of any of your blessings. For we came to you with nothing, and you have blessed us with everything. And so we're not going to tell you what to do. We're not going to demand anything from you, for all that we've received is just of your grace. But Father, we do ask this, that in your grace you might enable us to learn by our chastisement, to learn by the spankings we received in life, and be exercised by it so that we're stronger, we are corrected, we are going the right direction. And I ask, Father, that you so work that we would find that our foot is strengthened on the path, that the things that lure us, that entangle us, become less important than doing the right thing. So we pray, Father, tonight that our hearts might be challenged as Jacob's was. Perhaps you will give us some sort of a limp, that every time we falter on that step, we'll recognize that you have dealt with us and we have faced the consequences of our sin. We pray thy blessing then upon each one of us. In Jesus' name, amen.